It's time to talk about Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. And now, here's Ira.
My guest today is singer-pianist Patrick Hogan. He's performing with the Patrick Hogan Trio at Max and Jazz on June 21st. Patrick's love for jazz began early, inspired by the music of Frank Sinatra and the Great American Songbook. And by his teens, he was already performing professionally and later earned both bachelor's and master's degrees in jazz and commercial music from UNLV. And along the way, he developed into an artist who excels as both a pianist and a vocalist. Today, Patrick is one of Las Vegas's most respected musicians, having performed with legends like Wayne Newton, Clint Holmes, and Bob Anderson, and served as a principal pianist at Bellagio's Mayfair Supper Club. We'll talk about his musical journey, the Las Vegas jazz scene, and what audiences can expect at his upcoming Max and Jazz performance. For more information on Patrick's June 25th performance, go to maxandjazz.com, maxandjazz.com. For everything about Patrick, go to patrickhoganmusic.com, and you can follow him on Instagram. And Patrick, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. So rumor has it your parents introduced you to Frank Sinatra before you could even talk. Is that true? Can you confirm that?
That is accurate. You have good sources.
Thank you.
I had lots of musical influences growing up. Great jazz piano players, singers, writers for big bands. But when I was young and in the cradle, in the
school, which wasn't that long ago, Patrick, I'm looking at you and you look like you're 16, but that's just me.
I'm going to be 30 in a few days. So
congratulations.
Yeah, it's double that. And then you've got my age.
Okay.
In the Wee Small Hours was, used as a lullaby record for me in the cradle. So,
amazing.
I was exposed early.
You were, you know, I've had many jazz performers on the show, and we always talk about the Great American Songbook, and I won't bore our audiences too much with that, but it continues to delight me that more and more musicians and singers, performers, always go to the Great American Songbook, whether it's a jazz version or some other kind of version, because of the way the melodies are written, the way the lyrics are written in many cases, or the combination of the two. So when I get a chance to talk to someone like you, who obviously went to UNLV and studied and is now performing in Las Vegas on a regular basis, it there's a nice feeling to know that that music continues with someone who's not 60.
Oh, it's still very much alive. The repository of great American standards is enduring. The musical content, the poetic content, it's all so strong. You know, it's like Schubert's Lieder. It'll go on, you know, in perpetuity. And I can tell you, I tell this to people, that it's not just me as far as younger people who maintain an interest in this. It's never been easier for people to, you know, listen to music that they haven't heard before, discover great standards, you know, something that was recorded in 1958. TikTok helps facilitate that a lot. Mm-hmm. Because you'd be surprised at some of the great music from decades ago that will get popular on there. And people, you know, young people, there's a desire for this stuff, for sure.
Do you see a similarity? I always use this analogy. If you have a sense of humor, you can connect with people on that level regardless of what you do for a living and regardless of your age or where you come from.
That would require me to be funny.
Well, I think you are. But if people have a sense of humor, if one person has a sense of humor, the other person has a sense of humor, regardless of their differences in background or age, they can connect in a certain way, and it becomes a social lubricant. And I'm thinking that way in terms of the Great American Songbook, because again, here you are at a ripe old age of almost 30, and you could connect, I'm sure, with people who are in their 70s and 80s who remember that music from that time, right, in the 90s when it first came out. Because really, it's you're talking about the late 20s, 30s, and into the 40s.
Yeah, it starts back then and then has a legacy that continues through the ensuing decades.
Yeah, right. So when you are meeting people for the first time, perhaps when you're performing somewhere, and someone comes up to you who is not of your age but loves that music, I would assume there's an instant connection.
Yeah, it is a connector. And because younger people also like this stuff, you know, sometimes it connects with them in a different way. Mm-hmm. But it's like being a fan of the same sports team. You know, it means that you instantly have something that you can talk about.
Yeah, I like that analogy. I'll use that one instead of mine.
Yeah, it's all these things. You know, I think about this a lot. There's all these. Interests, creative or social or competitive, that allow us to be friendly with perfect strangers. Could be music, could be sports. For young people such as myself, a lot of the time it'll be like video games or something. Like everybody plays games. So you meet somebody and you say, "Oh yeah, you know, I've been playing such and such." And yeah, it's music is like that. It's a unifying factor.
So I'll throw out my sense of humor analogy, and I'll use sports. I think that's a better way to.
That's okay. I won't charge you royalties.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's what I usually tell my guests. You've been listening to too many of my shows then, because I usually come up with these ideas with guests, and then I tell them I just want a little bit of a royalty. I don't want to. So, again, we're on the same wavelength, which is shocking. All right.
Perfect.
So anyway, why did you decide, given your background, and I understand totally being in the cradle and hearing Frank Sinatra, You could automatically go to that side of the ledger, but you could have been a country music performer.
Well, it's kind of an interesting twisty turny kind of thing. So when I was growing up, the music that I was exposed to was, you know, the Sinatra, Nat King Cole stuff,
right?
You know, big band, straight ahead jazz, lots of, you know, mid-50s Miles Davis, Oscar Peterson records, Vince Guaraldi, stuff like that. Amon Jamal. And also some classical, and my mom would play me like old Beatlemania era Beatles stuff in the car, stuff like that. So the big sound of our household, you know, usually was jazz. Like if my dad was going to be cooking dinner on a Saturday night, then he would go and he'd put on a Red Garland album or something like that. So that was just what I was used to. And when I took up piano, I gravitated towards that stuff naturally. So the first thing that I got really, well, I like early on when I was young, like 3-4, I found myself really obsessed with like Sinatra type stuff. Time passes, you do different things. You know, you're a little kid, you're doing different things that take up your time. And then when I took up piano at 10, I got real obsessed with those straight ahead jazz records that my dad would play. So that was my big focus for many years, was small group jazz, also playing in big bands. And then eventually I came back to the Sinatra, Nat Holt type stuff years after that and had a new appreciation for it. And I wanted to do it myself. So I started, you know, experimenting with singing a little bit and eventually got serious about it.
Now, have you decided to go to the mecca of jazz and pop music in Hollywood as in terms of Capitol Records, where Sinatra performed, Nat King Cole performed, and others, including the Beach Boys?
Have I been in the building?
Yes, that's probably what I should have said. Have you been?
I wish, because I would love to be in there.
I won't get you jealous, but I got a tour of the building, and you could feel it when you're there.
Oh, I'm still jealous.
I know you are. I know you are.
I want to go in there. I know some people who have been in there. I know some people who have recorded in there. I'd like to go in there and not just take a tour. I'd like to use it. I mean, anybody can, if you've got, you know, you can go online. Anybody can call them and book a session.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It would be nice to, we have plans to do some recording coming up here pretty soon. of various kinds. And I don't think we would go and do it at Capitol right away, but eventually I'd like to get in there.
I think I could
because
see
it's you- a meaningful building for me.
Exactly. I could see you doing it. I could see it be worth, I hate to say the word investment, but be worth the investment to be able to go in there and get the vibes and perform and realize that you're in history.
Yeah, it would be worth the arm and the leg.
Yes, exactly. Not mine, yours.
Don't worry. I'm not going to barter with anybody's limbs but my own.
Okay, good. One of the videos I saw of you, and I was listening to your voice particularly, and I don't know if there's what I would call a standard or unique, or I don't know what the word would be, pertinent voice for jazz, but you do fit right into that genre. In other words, yes, absolutely. You do have this delivery that maybe I listen to too much jazz, but it's perfect. What I'm trying to say in my own tortured way is you have a great voice for jazz. It may not work as a country singer, as I mentioned earlier. And I don't know if they want you in the country music scene, but.
Well, I mean, jazz is my main passion. I do like, there are other kinds of music that I like a lot and that I would like to do individual songs, projects here and there, doing some other types of things. Like, you say country music. I'm not much for most country music that comes out now, but I'm very fond of, old Johnny Cash records, old Glenn Campbell records, stuff like that. I really enjoy that stuff. I like Elvis, things like that. So
I'm gonna book you for a gig at Folsom Prison. So I think that could work very well. It could work for Johnny Cash. It could work for Patrick.
Yeah, as long as they don't try to keep me there.
No, they won't.
I'm done.
No.
Yeah, no, I would do that. Yeah, for sure. But I like that that kind of stuff. But the my big passion, I still have that passion for small group instrumental jazz.
Were you?
But a lot of my bandwidth up here when I'm thinking about things I want to do is devoted to, I want to write this big band arrangement of something and then sing it.
Nice.
That's usually what's going through my mind.
Were you surprised at the jazz scene when you finally decided to professionally perform on a regular basis? I mean, you could, with your talent and what you learned at UNLV, you could travel and perform elsewhere, and you may do that as well. But are you surprised at how the jazz scene in Las Vegas has grown over the years?
No, I don't think so. I think that it's to be expected that you're going to have great musicians here. And where there are great musicians, there's usually going to be some jazz-oriented players. It's, arguably the entertainment capital of the world. So, and it has such a long history of great musicians being here and working here. So it doesn't really, I don't think it's really a surprise. I've had this theory for a while now that any major metropolitan area has some guys who can really play that you'll probably never hear of. But, like, they're there. Like, if I went to Cincinnati right now, there's probably guys in Cincinnati who are really world-class. It's just nobody knows who they are. I knew when I moved here that I would be able to work. And that was part of it. That was part of the decision. But I think it's lovely that there's more and more venues that focus on small group jazz, in addition to venues that focus on floor shows, the stuff on the strip, the big residencies that draw all the crowds, things like that.
Problem with, I think, the small jazz scene, and as you say, there are more and more venues that do it, is you're not going to get filthy rich, either as an owner or as a performer.
That's not really why we got into this, though. I don't think anybody starts playing this music because they want a burgeoning 401k.
No, I don't think so. Including the owners of the jazz clubs,
correct.
Yeah, I mean, but it's the love of the genre and the music and the feel and the musicians and the whole thing. So yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, you have to be passionate about it. It has to be something that you live and breathe, because otherwise you may as well just go and study accounting.
Now, you don't know this, but I've already told my audience that you're going to play Dave Brubeck's Take Five for us right now.
Right now?
No, that
with
was
what piano?
Well, I thought I'd throw in Dave Brubeck because you mentioned so many of the other people that
were. Yeah, if I had a piano, I would play it for you.
I know. I'm not. That was a joke. I didn't want to put you under any pressure.
Oh, I know, but I'm also am serious. If I did have a piano handy, I would play for you.
I appreciate it.
I'm always ready.
Yeah, well, you've got to get ready for your Capitol Records debut. So we're going to do that next.
God willing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It'll happen. Yeah. I'm very optimistic about it. I think it'll happen. If I had to pin you down to, I'll do the top three. I know there's so many to choose from, but the top three songs you like to play and sing, and maybe they'll be featured at Max and Jazz when you perform there with your trio on June 21st, or maybe not. But are there three top songs that just affect you from either the technical aspect, the emotional aspect, or you just respect them enough that this is what you want to always give to the audience?
Right. Well, first of all, there's so many songs to choose from. It's hard to pick favorites. I can tell you what my top favorite song to listen to, perform, what have you. My favorite song is, I can tell you the one favorite, and then I'll see if I can come up with another
two. Well, you're unusual, because most of the times when I ask a guest their top song, I don't do it all the time, but I will do it occasionally. And they usually say to me, well, I don't have one. There's more like three. So that's why I started with you on top three, not knowing that you would revert back to what I always wanted, which was the top one.
I know, which that you're right. That is rare. And obviously, like, I have many songs that I would refer to as special favorites.
I think I know what it is.
Top song?
Yeah, I know what
you're talking about. Take a guess.
Okay. I Can't Get Started, Buddy Berrigan.
No, but that is one of my, I would put that on a favorites list.
All right.
Maybe not top three, but it would be like on like a longer list of favorites.
Yeah. All right. Good.
Yeah. My favorite, let me put it this way. My favorite piece of music of any kind is I've Got You Under My Skin, as arranged by Nelson Riddle for Frank Sinatra.
That's almost too
I love
of an answer. That's
the
almost
song.
Too of an answer.
Yeah. The song is my favorite song. The arrangement is my favorite arrangement. The arranger and singer are my favorites in their respective capacity. And I think it's sort of like the perfect piece of accessible jazz crossed with, you know, what used to be considered pop music.
Right.
And so Under My Skin is the obvious top choice. And then some other songs that I love. Oof. I like How Long Has This Been Going On, the Gershwin song. I like Body and Soul. Those are two that come to mind right away. I like Old Devil Moon. From Finian's Rainbow, and probably like a few other like weepy ballads that I'm very fond of, like maybe something like This Is All I Ask.
Oh yeah,
Artie Jenkins tune, something like that. Yeah, but the obvious top choice for me is Under My Skin.
I have a question about that, Patrick.
Yeah,
I will admit to doing this, and if you will admit to doing it also, then I know we're definitely communicating. I can go for a while without playing that song, but when I do play it, I can't just play it once. I have to play it about three times or four times.
Yes. Well, I have I have the kind of obsessiveness about music, particularly music that I'm interested in, and also the ADHD diagnosis to go along with it, that I will if I find something that I really like that I want to learn from or just enjoy, I'll play it more than three or four times in a row. Like, I'll play it a lot. Like, an amount of times that you wouldn't even believe, so that I can keep absorbing it and appreciating it, you know, listening to different aspects of it. And that is, that particular arrangement is a good example of that, where, like, you know, whether it's the original recording from Songs for Swingin' Lovers or the re-recording from the early 60s or some live version, like, over and over and over and over and over and over and over again.
So when you listen to music, unlike civilians, when I listen to, let's use that, stay with that song for a second. When I
sure.
hear it, I'm absorbing it. That's your word, and I'll use it too for a moment. I won't pay a royalty for it, but I'll use it. When I nice. Absorb it, and there's just different elements that hit me if I play it two, three, or four, or maybe five times that I
yeah.
enjoy. But when you're listening to it, are you absorbing it? I'm thinking also from a musician's point of view.
And yeah.
Even a writer's point of view, you're picking out things that, boy, this fits here, this fits there, this lyric fits right on the beat, et cetera.
Right. The looking at it from the standpoint of the writing is a good example of what you're talking about, because, you know, I'll go through that, you know, and I'll be listening to it for the seventh time that day. And thinking, okay, I'm trying to like focus in and really listen to what he's doing, the choices that he's making with his string backgrounds, how they're voiced, when and where they're voiced, learning phrasing, like some of the written phrases, you know, particularly like from Nelson Riddle arrangements, like trying to absorb the melodic rhythm of it. You know, because melody has, you know, the pitch component, and then also the rhythmic component, the way that they're arranged, whatever the pitches are arranged in time. And in this particular example, sometimes the melodic rhythm is very, very important. So yeah, like, you know, you'll end up, you know, picking out different things to focus on. You know, you hear the trombone middle that builds up for the musical interlude for the umpteenth time, and you're trying to like think more about, you know, okay, how did he put this together and how does it all fit puzzle piece wise? You're thinking about the building blocks, and you're also like storing knowledge away for use later.
And do you emotionally connect with it in a more deeper way when you can hear a clean copy, a digital copy of it, versus perhaps a little bit more of a muddled version of it on vinyl from an old record?
Well, I love vinyl.
Well, we all love vinyl, but I'm thinking more from when you hear it where something's cleaned up, where you hear even other notes that you didn't hear in the vinyl version.
Sure, yeah. I think what you're talking about is more recognizable, like depending on the sound system that you're listening to it on, not necessarily the source of it. Yeah. Because unless you're like listening to a janky MP3 that you downloaded in 2002 off of LimeWire, vinyl is going to be very present and warm.
Yeah.
Digital has its own distinct sound and its own benefits. It's pretty easy to find good copies of things, whether you're streaming it or not. So at that point, it becomes more of a question of, am I listening to this on the $30 headphones that I bought from Walgreens? Or am I listening to it on the best speakers that I have?
Right.
You know, and then you know, there are definitely times, you know, I listen to music a lot in my car, and it's great to listen to it in my car. But sometimes, you know, you'll put something on, you know, a good pair of headphones or something like that, and you experience it differently, and it strikes you differently. You know, so it's definitely part of experiencing recorded music for sure.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Before I let you go, two other quick questions. When you were in UNLV, piano was your primary focus, but then the professors there, as I understand it, they suggested you also start singing. Was that when you first realized you wanted to combine those two elements?
So that's a good question. So I,
Patrick,
you know,
Patrick, I only ask good questions.
I understand now.
Thank you.
So as I said,
as a result, like, you'll be back on as a guest then. Once you
good. Yeah. Here, I'll you know, sort of do this a little bit more.
Yeah, that's fine.
like I said, I was exposed to great singing growing up, but when I started taking music seriously, piano came first, right? Then later on, when I got back into some of those records, some of those singing records, and I got really bitten by the bug and wanted to do it myself. That was before I came here, but I didn't start to really do it until I came here. Like when I was in community college in California, I would practice singing on my drive to and from my commute to and from school, and kicked around the idea and like did, you know, like one performance at one point, but really didn't do it that much. Then when I got here and I mentioned to, you know, Dave Loeb and the other people at UNLV, you know, I kind of want to do this. Do you think I should try this? And they're like, oh yeah, why not? You're in college. You should be trying stuff like that. Yeah. So I ended up working on working on that. I mean, to me, the biggest thing about UNLV was learning the finer points of writing. That was my biggest focus in school. But yeah, after they encouraged me, I thought, oh, why not? Sounds like fun. I should do it. I keep thinking about it. If I don't try, then I'll be mad at myself.
Oh, now you're not mad anymore. That's good. Before I let you go, I was mentioning earlier about what you might be performing at Max and Jazz on June 21st. Have you any ideas that you want to share with us?
Well, as
and also, do you want to mention the names of your trio as well? I always like to have them.
Well, it's Andrea D'Angelo on the drums, and Nick Schmidt on the bass. They are not merely the finest on their instruments, but also really close and wonderful friends of mine. Love those guys. Usually when we do our sets for the trio, it ends up being roughly a 50-50 split between standards or great songs written by jazz musicians like Thelonious Monk or Vince Guaraldi, and then 50% my stuff. And we kind of have like a repository of things that we like to play. So you'll probably hear some of my. Anytime you come here, the trio, you're probably going to hear us play like my tunes, like Cat and Mouse or Femme Fatale, and then you'll most likely hear us play Change Partners and The Song Is You, Just One of Those Things, stuff like that.
And of course, Take Five.
And of course, Take Five.
Yes,
because you didn't get to hear it now.
Right.
So the best that all that I can do is offer to play it there.
There you go. Oh, okay, perfect. Great way to leave it. My guest has been singer, pianist Patrick Hogan. He's performing with the Patrick Hogan Trio at Max and Jazz June 21st. And for more information, go to maxandjazz.com, maxandjazz.com. And for everything about Patrick, go to patrickhoganmusic.com and follow him on Instagram. And Patrick, thanks for being on the show.
Of course, the pleasure was all mine.
See you next time.
You've been listening to Talk About Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world.